Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the last panel of the afternoon. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Anyone who can't hear any of us at any time, put your hands up. And if we see you putting your hands up, we'll try and speak a bit more loudly. My name is Martin Edwards. I'm the participating moderator of this panel, which is called Forgotten Authors. I hasten to add that the forgotten authors we're talking about are not the five people in front of you.
Not yet.
But this is the third year that I've had the pleasure and the privilege of moderating this particular panel. And it's really all about the enthusiasm of modern day authors for authors of the past, and some names who perhaps deserve to be remembered, but have by and large been forgotten. And it's all about enthusiasm. It's all about trying to engender some enthusiasm in yourselves, and that's what really has been such a great pleasure in the panels of the past couple of years. We have a great panel. I've had the pleasure of appearing on panels with each of these writers over the years on a number of occasions. And I think by strange coincidence, three of them are published by Seven House, who appear in the back of the room, I think. So they're going to be on the best behaviour because the publishers are watching. So it makes change, do I hear you say? I'm going to move to the panel members one by one. And before they launch into an account of one, or in Caroline's case, a couple of their chosen authors, I'm going to ask them to say a few brief words about their latest title. Again, not least because the publishers are in the room. but it is I think worth remembering that these are amongst the best of the modern authors whose enthusiasm for the people who've written many years ago, I think, will transmit itself to all of you this afternoon. I'd like to start by introducing my colleague Peter Guttridge.
Hello. As it happens, Martin has very kindly brought a copy of my latest book with him, so I can wave it around. I wasn't expecting to be able to do that. It's called The Last King of Brighton. It's the second of a rather gloomy trilogy. It's not gloomy at all, but it's very severe. It's a very serious trilogy set in Brighton. The first one, The City of Dreadful Night, came out a few months ago. The third one is going to come out in October. So this is kind of the midway point. I love the cover that Seven House, I am one of those Seven House authors, has done. And it's about the making of a gangster in Brighton in the 60s, which I'm far too young to remember, so I had to do a lot of research. I'm not expecting laughs for that, excuse me. And then also set in the present day with some rather horrible things happening around Brighton. It's been a great thrill to be to work on this trilogy and to have the support of a publisher who was very keen to have the trilogy. And I'm even more pleased that my publishers have asked for books 4 and 5 of the trilogy. This is a private joke. I was very happy to continue the series. I realised that there was more to say, that I couldn't say it all in the trilogy because, as you can tell, I'm very long-winded. I will stop now.
And now, Peter, moving on to one of my favourite forgotten authors, John Franklin Bardeen.
Yeah, John Franklin Bardeen. I discovered John Franklin Bardeen. This is the only copy. This is a book that came out in the 70s in England with an introduction by Julian Simmons. It's a Penguin. It's a Penguin omnibus of his best three novels. He wrote 10 altogether. But these three were actually his masterpieces, I think, and most people think, if I'm honest. I picked this up when I was at university back in the 70s. I was just getting into reading crime fiction. I was making my way through Chandler and all the greats. And I found this, and I like the cover. You can't probably see it from here, but there's a kind of distorted face, like in a distorted mirror face. And I was fascinated by these. These were the first real psychological thrillers I'd read, and they were published between 1946 and 1948 probably, so they were kind of out of time in terms of the kind of manic stuff that goes on in here, because they are about insanity and about mental disintegration, and they've also got some of the best titles I've ever come across. If I can tell you what the titles of the three books in this omnibus are, the first one is called, and I never quite know how to pronounce this, so forgive me, The Deadly Percheron, or Percheron. The second is called The Last of Philip Banter. But the third is called Devil Takes the Blue Tail Fly. Great titles, every single one. The opening of the Deadly Percheron, the first one in here, it goes like this. Jacob Blunt was my last patient. He came into my office wearing a scarlet hibiscus in his curly blonde hair. He sat down in the easy chair across from my desk and said, Doctor, I think I'm losing my mind. That, for me, is the start of a great novel.
Yeah.
And he continues like that. I think the endings of the first two are not great. I think it can't fulfill kind of what is... It's more about the insanity, really, than about a properly plotted novel. But I think the third one, the Blue Tail Fly, is perfectly plotted as well. They all deal with insanity. He was born in 1916 in Cincinnati. He had some traumas when he was an adolescent and when he was a teenager. He'd gone off to university to study engineering, and then his father, who was a slightly dodgy businessman, had died, and also a sibling had died. So he'd had to abandon that, and he went to worked as a bouncer in a skating rink, as I think I'm right in saying. And then he got into advertising in a kind of slightly odd way. And then he wrote these three books over an 18-month period between 46 and 48, as I said. The first two were published first in America, then in England by Victor Gollancz. The third was not published in America until 1967, in fact, although it was published in England. They didn't do very well. He went off to do his other work. He ended up writing another seven novels, I think five or six of which were written under the name Gregory Tree. These weren't great. These were kind of fairly formulaic crime novels. But there was something about these, and what I like about the three in here is that they are clearly a writer who is not quite in control of what they're writing, which is why the plotting isn't as kind of perfect as it might be. Not in control of his writing, but for that reason, it has a power that is rarely matched. Julian Simmons, who writes the intro to this, says that for him, it compares with Patricia Highsmith and even Edgar Allan Poe. Pretty good comparisons.
Yeah.
Bardin, sorry, it's John Franklin Bardin, B-A-R-D-I-N. And I should say in the introduction, Julian Simmons says that there was a speech by a man who at the time was a very well-known English politician that the people from England, if they're of a certain age, will have heard of, called Dennis Healey, who was our Chancellor of the Exchequer for many, many years. And he was apparently, I didn't realise this, very erudite as a crime reader. And he, in a speech to a Crime Writers Association do, said one of my favourite writers is John Franklin Bardin. The fact that he was in charge of our finances whilst he was liking somebody who wrote about insanity is for me slightly worrying, but aside from that, if he can recommend it as well, then I think that's pretty good.
thanks, Peter. Worrying, but not entirely surprising, perhaps. Spookily, I too bought that same edition when I was a student. So we were meant to be on this panel.
Absolutely,
together.
Absolutely. I'll put it all back so you can see it.
Yeah, absolutely great omnibus. Is that right?
Oh, I didn't know that.
I didn't know that. The Last of Philip Banter, which is a great concept because it's a book about a writer whose book starts to come true.
Yes.
That's in a spooky and bad way.
Yeah.
Needless to say. So
one of those great high concept things.
Yeah.
In fact, which again at the time nobody was doing high concept in inverted commas. Yeah.
That's absolutely right. But certainly didn't know it had been filmed. Now the next speaker is Caroline Todd. I'm going to ask Caroline after she's introduced herself to talk about two authors together quite briefly, but I have to say these are two authors I've never heard of, absolutely never heard of. So not so much forgotten as certainly plumbing the depths of my ignorance. Caroline.
Fortunately, before I set sail for England, we had handed in our next two books. The next best, Crawford, comes out in August. It's The Bitter Truth. We've done The Galleys. The next Routledge for next January is The Confession, and I am told that the minute I land in Delaware, the copy edits will be sitting on our doorstep, so no time to have problems with jet lag. But my son and I have enjoyed the two series. We write them together, and it's been a pleasure.
Under the name of Charles Todd, I should.
Yes, Charles Todd is the name we write under. George Shipley. He was born in 1908 and died in 1982, so you can see he's fairly contemporary. He had three careers. He was a cavalry officer in the Indian Army. He retired as a lieutenant colonel, became a schoolmaster at a friend's school, and at the age of 60 began to write historical novels. His first was Imperial Governor. It's the memoir of the Roman general Suetonius Paulinus, who had to deal with Queen Boudica. His other novels are in the same style. They are set in history. Night in Anarchy follows the struggle between King Stephen and the Empress Matilda. The Paladin and the Wolf Time go back to the time of William Rufus. His research is impeccable. The novels are beautifully written. And because he was a cavalry officer, his war scenes are considered some of the best in historical novels. But the thing that, the book that introduced me to George Shipley was a little one called The Yellow Room. It was published in England as The Chilean Club. The Chilean Walla Club was the officers' club for the 6th Hussars, who had been disgraced back in the 1800s in England, in India. And these men sat around looking at the past, realizing that they had not done anything to save the name of their unit or to make themselves in some way fulfill what their career had not produced for them and for England. So this was set in 1971, and he decided, the officer who is the central character, decided that the political situation in England at that time was rather messy, and it was up to the Chilean Club to do something about it. So they set out to assassinate Union leaders, left-wing agitators, and a bishop, all paid by the Russians. Now, this, what he hoped, would set England to rights. Now, the problem was, in 1971, this was too close to the truth. The Union readers hated him. The politicians hated him. Nobody liked him. He almost lost his reputation. However, it's a clever assassination story. And I read it not knowing about this political background until after I had finished it. So I enjoyed it thoroughly. And there's a twist at the end that you have to look at and decide how you feel about it. But I think it's time for that Yellow Room to be read again and seen in a different light, because it's really, really enjoyable, as are all of his other novels. I highly recommend him. William Barrett, on the other hand, is an American. He was born in New York City, moved to Denver, and had two early interests, flying and his Catholic faith. He began his career writing term papers for his fellow students in college, with a guarantee that if the student didn't get an A, that the sum would be refunded. And as far as we know, nobody ever claimed a refund. He later became a freelance writer for corporations and associations and so on. But his first work of writing was nonfiction. He wrote the biography of the Paraguayan president Francisco Lopez and his mistress Eliza Lynch. He also wrote another bio, that of Pope Paul VI, called The Shepherd of Mankind. I got to know him instead as a writer of fiction, and you will probably remember him most as the author of The Left Hand of God, which was a wonderful movie with Humphrey Bogart about a soldier of fortune in China right after the war who took the role of a dying priest to allow him to escape from the men who were pursuing him. Has some very interesting philosophy in it, but it's a very, very good adventure story as well. He also wrote Lilies of the Field, which you may remember with Sidney Poitier, about the young black man who helps the nuns finish their church. Another one was The Wine and the Music, where a man who is a priest has to judge between his, or choose between his Catholic faith and a woman he loves. But what took me aback, what really sold me on William E. Barrett, was a short novella called The Edge of Things. It begins with a young pilot in World War I who is so fiercely determined not to die when his number comes up that he touches the edge of things. And when he does, something happens that I thought was amazingly believable and in many ways heart-wrenching because it took in two wars. But I highly recommend The Edge of Things. I think it's probably a good way to get to know him. Certainly it had something to do with my own love of World War I.
Thank you, Caroline. Fascinating. And now I'd like to introduce Sarah Rain, and Sarah will speak first about an author I've never read, but do remember seeing his books in the library some years ago, Peter Van Greenaway. Sarah.
Thank you, Martin. Just to give you the brief intro, I write mainly psychological thrillers, which are usually referred to as being dark, the past influencing the present very strongly. The latest one in that genre is called What Lies Beneath. Alongside that, I've just started a series of ghost books, which is something I've wanted to do for many years, so that's something I'm particularly happy about. And the first of that series is called Property of a Lady. Peter Van Greenaway. Many years ago, when I first thought I would like to write a book, I came up with what I fondly thought was a very original concept, a hitherto undiscovered Shakespearean play for which people would commit murder. Actually, I even wrote a few lines of blank verse, and it obviously didn't get anywhere. But a few years later, I read a book called The Destiny Man by an author called Peter Van Greenaway, and I understood instantly why mine hadn't got anywhere. It's a book that blew me away. It's how a has-been actor living on his past glories finds a yellowing Shakespearean folio on the tube and how he manages to bring the play to production at Stratford. Where else? The crime books that Van Greenaway wrote focus on his Inspector Cherry, who's a widower living alone and doesn't cope very well with domesticity. And if there's a scholarly twist to a puzzle, he can usually come up with the appropriate background. He also has a faithful and dogged sergeant, Sergeant Duff, who occasionally tries to matchmake for his boss. So there's the nice homely touches as well. And in fact, I would love to have brought Inspector Cherry and Duff together with Morse and Lewis, because I can see Lewis and Duff would be talking football over the beer and their families. Morse and Inspector Cherry would have unravelled the more arcane mysteries, probably using crossword clues, Wagner and Elizabethan blank verse. his writing is quite beautiful. In The Destiny Man, he sprinkles the text with bardic phrases. When an antiquarian bookseller, Elias Pouncefoot, which is very nearly Restoration, isn't it, is found murdered, the reactions are described like this. The news broke about 5, perfectly timed for radio, TV, and late evening paper coverage. A new, unpublished, unknown play, never before performed until soon. There was matter enough to generate interest. But this new circumstance, the murder of Pouncefoot, almost melted wires and made the ionosphere crackle audibly as news of it girdled the earth. Here was a combination of events devoutly to be wished. And in another of, he wrote six of these books, by the way. In one called The Killing Cup, the focus is the sale of a small church cupboard with a secret drawer, which is believed to be the hiding place of the cup used by Christ at the Last Supper. And the emotions of a character are described in this way. He's just been told that there are more than one versions of the supposed Last Supper cup. And his thoughts go like this. In a mad, mercifully fleeting moment, he saw the whole supper service in Leonardo da Vinci's wall-to-wall representation gathered up in a white tablecloth and hurriedly sold to the first bidder as a job lot. There could be cups and platters all over the place. Just brief background. I'm not sure if I hit on a separate mystery when I was preparing for this panel. I thought it might be interesting to find out a bit about the background of some of these forgotten authors. And I couldn't find out anything about Peter Van Greenaway, except that he was born in London in 1929, died in 1988, and he was a lawyer turned novelist. There you go, Martin. And actually, for that fragment of information, I'm indebted to Christopher Fowler, who I know shares a great admiration with me for this author. In fact, he's probably the only other person I've ever met who's read him, although I'm sure there are a lot of others. He wrote for television, odds and ends here and there. But the very few sources I could find all agree on one thing. The very lack of information about him is intriguing. I even wrote to his publishers, who were Gallants, now Orion, I think. Courteous and apologetic reply, no archives about him. But actually, I quite like that small mystery. Who was he? Was it the pseudonym of a well-known person or writer hiding his or her real identity? And actually, I say that, I can see at least six people making notes for a plot for a writer who kept his identity a dark secret. He also wrote political thrillers, some books that have elements of science fiction. And I focused largely on the six crime books here. I have a list of the titles if anybody would like them. But I can't not mention one of his political titles, because it's worth knowing for everyone here who ever struggled to think up a title. And it's called The Man Who Held the Queen to Ransom and Sent Parliament Packing. He hardly even needs jacket notes, does it? Needs a large jacket. So that's Peter Van Greenaway.
Thanks, Sarah. That's great. Next panelist who's going to speak about an author who, well, two authors in fact in due course, who were both phenomenally famous in the day, I think, but now perhaps not so. Adrian Maxson.
Hello. My name's Adrian Maxson. I have to say the two that I'm going to talk about, and one of them first, absolutely, I think, can say I've formed the way I ought. What I write about, the view that I have of the characters I like to write about. And I'm lucky enough to have two series currently going. One is with Seven House, like Peter, which is a current spy series, so very like one of the ones I'm going to talk about, in a sense that it covers the same sort of field. And it's to do with an MI5 officer who goes through some troubled times, and then in subsequent books has to still retain a link with the field. And it was something I'd always wanted to write. And this book, which I'm going to talk about in a second, is by Adam Dement, was probably one of the reasons that made me want to write spy books. I'd always wanted to do them. Before this, I wrote crime novels. And the other series I've got is a French series, French police series, set in the 60s in France. Largely, that came about because I was educated in France as a small child, and so I know the area, and I always felt I wanted to try something to write about, trying to tap into the love at the moment in this country of European-based fiction, and basically try and get all these Scandinavians out of the way. Haven't done it yet, but I'm working on it. Adam Dement is the author I want to talk about, and not an awful lot of is known about him. Another one that seems to be largely unknown, not only forgotten, nobody, you speak to a lot of people about it, and they say, who? Adam Dement, his first novel came out in 1967, which is in the sort of the high days of London's flower power culture. I mean, it was all happening, and he was very much part of that, it seemed. He dressed the part. He was young, blonde, hip. And especially for our American friends here today, I can read a bit that was said about him by Anthony Boucher. He said, Philip McAlpine, who is the central character in Adam Dement's novels, is described as an agent who smokes hashish, leads a highly active sex life, kills vividly, uses or even coins the latest London slang, and still seems a perfectly real and even oddly likeable young man rather than a reflected Bond image. Well, we were all hoping to do that in the 60s. And he fitted the picture of, he was tall, blonde. If any of you remember David Hemmings, the actor,
yes.
He was going to play the part of Philip McAlpine in a film that was to be made, which never actually got off the ground. And they looked remarkably similar. He wrote four novels, and they were all about Philip McAlpine, this young, rather reluctant agent, working for a very dark department of British intelligence. And I always thought his boss fitted, in terms of name, absolutely the rather nasty underhand character that probably employs a lot of spies. His name was Quine. And to me that, I hope there's nobody called Quine in the room, is there? But that seemed to me a great name for somebody who was of that character. He wrote just four books, sadly. The Dolly Dolly Spy was one, 1967. The Great Spy Race was another. One which I paused to actually mention, The Bang Bang Birds, which is not like you might think, I have to tell you. And Think Inc. was the fourth. And then he disappeared. He just dropped off the map. Now, why was I drawn to these? Well, I went to a rather traditional boarding school, English boarding school, where we were reared on things like Westerns, Zane Grey, Louis L'Amour, because they were clean, and Bulldog Drummond, and that kind of thing, 39 Steps. And sex was really what they kept the potatoes in. And it's an old one, but it's a good one. And when I left this rather strict establishment, I mean, when a Hank Jansen or Mickey Spillane came in rather illicitly, as they did occasionally, you could sell almost anything for a read of one of those books. Because, you know, we just didn't get that kind of stuff. It was great. When I found Adam Dement, I had left school, and I rather thought this captured me immensely, because I think I'm one of the few people I know, or perhaps I haven't spoken to enough people, I couldn't quite get on with Ian Fleming. There was just something I didn't quite connect with it. But I loved the books by Adam Dement, perhaps because I wanted to be like the guy in this book. It was freewheeling, it was hip, it was far more amusing than I found the Fleming books, which I found quite formal in a way. But to me, it captured the essence of the 60s in London. And he then dropped out of sight, which was a great shame, because there were lots of people that said he had a great future. I mean, one of the other book jacket pieces was the most modern hero in years. He's hip, he's hard, he likes birds, and sometimes marijuana. He was of the time. The reading now is slightly dated. I say slightly. I've just read this one again, and I found it actually still held my attention, although a lot of the language is of the time and so on, and certainly some of the views are of the time. But I found it just an exciting read still. And to me, that's all a book needs to do. Yes, it took me back a little bit to when I first read it, but I can still remember. Even though I was there in the 60s, it was still a good read. He told a good story, and to me, that's what I liked about it. It had a good conclusion. He was a nice character, sometimes not always terribly nice, but he fitted the bill for what I saw in these books. And there's been great speculation that he was the pseudonym of somebody like Gavin Lyle or John Gardner, who also wrote spy books, as you know. But there's also great speculation that he just had enough of writing after four books. And there's been a little bit of a hunt going on the internet about him for quite some time. Rumours that he's retired to farming in Kent. Other rumours is that he went to the Far East to follow the sort of the trail of the marijuana and the, you know, the various sort of things that went on. Nobody knows. So he's a bit of a man of mystery, and maybe that's partly what holds me and what took me back to these books. So Adam Dement, you can still get some of his books. I think Peter's got three, haven't you?
I've got three out of those four, yeah.
Yeah.
You should wave the, show them the cover.
Yes, you can't see it from here. Yeah. You know, the great thing about the books in the 60s, they're so thin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Easily digestible on a train journey. You know, great.
That's super. Thanks, thanks, Adrian. I want to put in a word for the publishers, the small publishers who are bringing back some forgotten authors nowadays.
Yes.
And print on demand is a technology which is enabling very small print runs. And not just for contemporary writers, but for writers of the past who aren't particularly well known to a modern generation of readers, but whose books are taking on a fresh life. And there are a couple of publishers I'd like to draw to your attention specifically, because they've done a lot of good work in the last year or two. Ostara Publishing, who produce a number of very attractive books, and Langtail Press. In fact, that's a small enterprise run by the great grandson of Agatha Christie, and I'll say something more if time permits about Langtail and one of their authors a bit later on. But Ostara publish, amongst many other books, one book by Canon Victor L. Whitechurch. He was quite a prominent writer who combined his clerical duties with detective fiction. And the book that Ostara publishes called Crime at Diana's Pool, which is quite a readable whodunit. He doesn't play fair, which is very, very naughty, because at one point, about halfway through the story, one of the key characters, one of the detectives, gets a crucial piece of information and we're not told what it is. But apart from that, heinous lapse from good taste. He does a good job, I think, in keeping the reader entertained. And Victor Whitechurch is certainly a writer to keep an eye out for. He was perhaps most famous. He was very keen on railways, and in pre-privatisation days. And he had a railway detective. Of course, there are a couple of very good railway detective series nowadays, but I think Victor Whitechurch had the first one. And his detective was called Thorpe Hazel. He was a vegetarian and a hypochondriac. And he investigated crimes that took place on trains. And these weren't timetable railway stories. They were short stories. And pretty entertaining they were too. So Victor Whitechurch is certainly a name I think worth looking out for if you can spot any of those books. Now, Peter, I'd like to come back to you, if I may, to speak about a writer of the pretty distant past, Charles Feeling.
Yeah, this is a slight cheat for me. I hadn't really heard of Charles. I was aware of Charles Felix, who, according to Julian Simmons, again, the great critic of crime fiction, the British critic of crime fiction, said that he wrote the first modern detective story, which came out in 1862 in serial form and 1863 as a novel. It was called The Notting Hill Mystery. Charles Felix was, in fact, a pseudonym of a guy which we think is a guy called Charles Warren Adams, who was a lawyer who also had a small publishing house. I guess almost he was one of the first self-published authors, in that the next Charles Felix book came out under his imprint and it was called The Velvet Lawn. I haven't read The Velvet Lawn. It's kind of an interesting title. I'm not quite sure what kind of book it is, actually. But the Notting Hill Mystery, it came out around the same time as Wilkie Collins's The Woman in White. So it's kind of, if you think of The Woman in White as the first mystery novel in English. This is a distinction between that and the first modern detective novel, because of course Wilkie Collins's kind of more detective novel, The Moonstone, came out in 1868. So the Notting Hill mystery preceded that. I would be waving it around, but it's on my computer. You can download it from the internet fairly easily. It's an intriguing story. It's an intriguing story, but it doesn't. You know from the start. It's actually a whodunit, which in those days was really unusual. You know, it was well ahead of its time. According to Julian Simmons, he was doing stuff in this book that nobody was doing until the 1920s. It was a whodunit. It's about a baron. And if I tell you what the initial murder is, you'll see why almost straight away you can figure out that maybe the baron is quite guilty. It's the death of the baron's wife. The baron is called Baron P or something. It's one of those kind of Victorian books where you don't get the full name. And the wife was sleepwalking one night and sleepwalked into the baron's private laboratory where she drank a glass of acid. This, of course, happens all the time in modern crime fiction. not quite. So you know from this, you fairly pretty much know from the start that Baron is going to be guilty. So I'm not giving anything away by saying that. It turns out there are two or three other murders involved with the story, but it is interesting because you can't figure out exactly how he managed the actual murder and the other two murders. And what's interesting is the way that the book is structured. It's an insurance investigator is the narrator. But the way that he narrates is in a very modern way, because he does it through medical reports, through scientific analysis reports, through bits of diary, through letters. He uses a whole range of documentary evidence. He's compiling, actually, a kind of file on this baron. And what you get in this book is this file, essentially, coming in different ways. I was reminded of a couple of Minette Walters' novels, Acid Rome and the Snakes one, Shape of Snakes, which uses lots of different things to pull a story together in a really interesting way. This guy was doing this in 1862. In terms of his mysteries, I think this was the only one he ever did. Then Wilkie Collins came along, kind of stole a lot of the mystery thunder. It's a quick read. You can download it very cheaply. It's worth a read, I think. I'll say no more than that, really. It's an interesting piece of history.
Yes, thanks, Peter. We are, as always on this panel, running remarkably short of time already, and we've got loads of authors to talk about, but you will also have lots of questions, I suspect, as well. So I'm going to ask the panellists to speak very, very briefly, if I may, on one of their other chosen writers. And can we start with you, Adrian, and Leslie Charteris?
Yes. I've always loved Leslie Charteris. I started reading it when I was about eight, and a lot of the language just went over my head, but I just love the idea of this rather freebooting character. And it probably plays forward into the spy series, which I'm writing at the moment, in that a character is able to do things which are slightly outside of the norm. And the saint, of course, was very outside the norm. He operated outside the bounds of normal society, but he basically spent his life biffing the baddies, and didn't really have a great deal of time for the police. And I kind of liked that. I thought, yeah, I like somebody who's not strictly followed by procedure or controlled by procedure. And for that reason, I found the books wonderful. Even from the age of eight, it seemed to appeal to me greatly. And so I think it formed part of what I like to write about now. And I heard just recently that there is a new spy film, Saint film coming out with James Purfoy. I don't know how true that is, but I'll be interested to see, because everybody's got, like Bond, everybody's got their favourite saint. I'll be interested to see what this new one is like. So yeah, Leslie Charteris, I like it. A little bit dated, because it's going back to the 30s when it was written. But one thing I got from this, I think, and it only really occurred to me recently, is I like to try and write with a backdrop of what is going on at the moment. And in a lot of Leslie Charteris books, he took the backdrop of the approaching war and what was going on in society. It wasn't absolutely up there for you to see all the time, but he really had a mention of, in the case of Nazism and all of that, there was that backdrop. So I like to do that myself, and I think maybe that's where it came from, was that I enjoyed a story of crime, but set against something else.
Super, thanks, Adrian. And Sarah, you have another one.
Yes, Patricia Wentworth, who probably isn't, yes, I thought that would happen. She's not so much forgotten, is she? In fact, I think I saw on Amazon recently that quite a lot of the titles are being reissued. She wrote the Maud Silver books, an awful lot of them, and most of you, I'm sure, will know them. They're a good version of the country house, English village murder. Miss Silver is a retired governess. Her words are, "It's many years since she gave up the scholastic profession." And she sort of hypnotises people with knitting and the constant flow of Alfred Tennyson verse. The plots are well thought out, the characters are well-rounded, but I have to say, at times, rereading some of them for this evening's panel, I got quite exasperated with some of the heroines. Viewed from today's outlook, they have virtually no spirit. Running a house is a full-time job, and if they're left without money, there's usually a relative they can go to live with. And yet, there's something relaxing and gentle about that era. You know that good will triumph, the killer will get his or her comeuppance, the boy will get the girl, and Miss Silver will start knitting for their children. But they even go back beyond the 1950s. There's perhaps an elderly aunt who remembers when times were so different. If, for instance, the post is brought in, because the characters still have housemaids who bring the post in, something might be said, "Oh, well, when I was a girl, the post was not brought to us. It went straight to father before we were allowed to see it." And it's maddening, and it's almost incomprehensible. And it makes you want to dash off and chain yourself to the nearest railings and demand the vote. But again, if you're struggling with a difficult plot twist or juggling money until the next lot of royalties comes in, it does sometimes make you wonder how nice it might have been to live in that kind of protected world. Mm. As long as you can import, I don't know, washing machines, mobile phones, modern dentistry. So there were 32 Miss Silver books, 4 Benbow Smiths, 2 Frank Garrett's. I'm sorry, this is sounding like the 12 Days of Christmas. The titles are too numerous to mention, but they're the Miss Silver books, and they're very gentle and relaxing.
Sarah, thank you. And again, very briefly, if you will, please, Caroline, Adam Hall.
Adam Hall was actually one of the pseudonyms of Elston Trevor. He used quite a few pseudonyms and liked one of them so much he had his name changed to Elston Trevor rather than Trevor Dudley Smith. Adam Hall, I never read Nancy Drew, I have to admit. Adam Hall was more to my liking. Jeremy talked about him in an earlier panel. He's a spy for hire. Ferris is his handler. Quiller is his case name. And he's sent down the ferret hole, as he describes it, to find out what is going on and how it should be dealt with. It's nonstop action. It's nonstop fear, terror, whatever you want to say, as he tries as one man to solve whatever the case may be, and he doesn't always know what he's been sent down the ferret hole to do. And I just love the books. They're wonderfully modern in their own way. I think they read better than James Bond. He's got a remarkable grip of the fear and the planning and the skills and the intent of someone who has to work alone. And I think they have survived very, very well.
And the Quiller Memorandum was a film based on one of those books.
And I don't think the film or the TV series did it credit, but it did win an Edgar for Mystery Writers of America.
It was pretty good, though. Joystick Owl was
pretty good.
Very good soundtrack as well. Right, we're very short of time. I'm sorry there won't be time for a lot of questions, but there is a prize for the best question, so who's going to be brave enough to raise them? We'll answer very quickly so as to cram a few in.
Which authors do you think will be forgotten in the
future? Nobody in this room. Another question, please.
Yes. Yes, it was. It was, I've got a note, I'm, you know, terribly efficient. filmed in 1978 with Richard Burton and Lee Remick, and it's about a novelist who possesses telekinetic powers. Apparently, Inspector Cherry was turned into a French detective, yeah, which, you know, the ways of filmmakers are wonderful, aren't they? Mm. Yeah, that's interesting, you know of it. That's right.
The film actually follows the novel to a degree.
Mm-hmm. I meant to try and get a copy of the DVD, you know, for this session, and I didn't get around to it, but I might do that now.
And a novelist with telekinetic powers, never underestimate P.D. James, that's all I have to say.
Right, the question is, how do we feel about authors picking up old characters and reinventing them? This is obviously a dig at my future Hercule Poirot series. Oh, joking. Adrian.
If they do it well, I don't mind. I think some characters have got great mileage in them. And if the story is told well, and it is perhaps using a slightly more modern setting, or a more modern language, it can work. I haven't read any that are really bad, so I can't comment on those, but I think if it's done well, then yeah, why not?
Caroline?
I don't know. I don't always think it works. It depends on why and how the author is doing it.
Peter?
If you're thinking of the New Frost, I like the idea of that, and well, not particularly Frost, but there is the New Frost, and I know one of the co-writers, Rowell Henry Sutton, who's a fine writer, so I'm quite excited about the kind of sensibility he's going to bring to Frost, so I'm quite excited about that.
How do you get publishers to introduce these books back to the public? And can we have a list of the names of the authors that you mentioned, because many of them, since they are unknown, remain unknown, unless people want to write their names down somewhere.
Yes, speak to us afterwards or email me, and I'll
okay.
be happy to provide
a
list of all the authors mentioned. Yeah. Another question, lady there.
Would anyone on a panel like to speak about a forgotten writer that they like who's not a mystery writer, who writes in some other genre or
non-fiction? Would we like to speak about a non-mystery writer?
Who's the first to say
who it is?
I would, but I don't know if we have time.
Very, very briefly.
Very briefly. It's R.C. Sheriff.
Journey's
End, everybody knows him for. But he wrote a book called, it was published as The Hopkins Manuscript and also The Cataclysm. And that's, if you can, it's now in print again, I think, as The Hopkins Manuscript. And that's my Desert Island book. It's worth a try for the picture of an English village, a very self-centered man who, because of a huge catastrophe, becomes less self-centered and egocentric. It's super.
Thank you. Now, time unfortunately has beaten us, as it always does. I think we have to decide on the best question. Any views on that?
By common consent.
Actually, I've got a copy here of Adam Dement and a copy here of The Saint Meets the Match. If anybody wants them, the first one who beats a path up to here gets them.
Adrian, that's your history, that's your childhood there.
It's The Saint I want it.
All right, give me the other one back then. Adam Dement, yeah, Bill.
I have
pleasure.
Every copy.
My God.